It is Friday, November the 10th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, analysis of President Trump's Asia trip, plus Asian feelings about U.S. positions on trade.
Vietnam, Singapore, other countries in the region were disturbed not only on the specifics of trade, not only the specifics of that particular agreement, but in general what that said about the American attitude towards all of them.
Trump and Xi interacting in Beijing, Tanzanian women, farmers, plus the sounds of Mel Carter. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. President Trump arrives in Vietnam today, the latest leg of his 12-day sweep across East Asia, in which he is discussing trade, diplomatic relations, and North Korea. Mr. Trump will attend an APEC summit in Vietnam, where leaders of the major economies in the region will be discussing growth and regional cooperation. In Beijing on Thursday, the president struck a markedly softer tone than in the past on some touchy subjects such as North Korea and trade when meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping. VOA's Lori London talks to former U.S. Ambassador Cameron Munter about what to expect when it comes to the issue of trade, especially since it was an issue on which Mr. Trump campaigned when running for president.
There's the tendency throughout the trip, I think, to begin to talk about bilateral trade and mm-hmm. to defend his decision to pull out of the Trans-Pacific Trade
right.
Agreement.
Right.
And that's something that I think will only become more of a headline as he goes on to Vietnam and on to the Philippines, et cetera, and goes to APEC and ASEAN as he plans to do. Mm. And I think the one thing that's kind of tricky here is that it's easy to talk about getting a good deal in saying, instead of going on these multilateral agreements, let's get the good deal, let's go in there and do the bilateral trade. What is troubling about this is that most people who've worked in international affairs know that you can have a strategy to go and do that, but the way to negotiate a trade agreement is painstaking negotiations that take a very long time. To do that for a bunch of countries is hard, but to do it individually with, that is, a bunch of countries together is hard, but to do it individually with those same countries is an effort which, just in terms of time and personnel and people, is much more difficult at a time when, for example, at the State Department, you don't have a lot of people in positions to be part of the kind of implementation of a deal like this. Now, I realize this would be mainly people from the more economic ministries like Commerce or Trade Rep or Treasury, but I hope that the American administration realizes, is thinking, that by wanting to do a series of individual trade agreements, they're making demands on the American bureaucracy that they have to make sure they have the bureaucrats to implement. You have to have people to make these things happen. And every time Trump says something like, well, you know, I'm the one who matters, you don't have to have other diplomats because, you know, I'm the one who makes the decision, that's absolutely true. He is the one who makes the decision. But the people who work out the details and implement that, so careful what you wish for when you want to do a series of bilateral trade deals instead of one multilateral trade deal. It's very hard to do. Very time-consuming.
I know that the Asian nations were not happy that the U.S. pulled out of the deal.
No, and it's not only the question of the Asian nations were not happy about that, but they were also unhappy about what that signified about the American commitment to multilateralism and to their own collective interests. So, for example, Vietnam, Singapore, other countries in the region were disturbed not only on the specifics of trade, not only the specifics of that particular agreement, but in general what that said about the American attitude towards all of them. So that this is, many people, and I agree with this assessment, is this was a huge blow to American prestige in the region as a country that kept its word and as a country that felt that it was the guarantor of rules-based trade practices in the region. Now it's going to be, if the Americans are able, a series of bilateral agreements, which will take a very long time to negotiate and which will not be similar, so that you'll not be treating the different friends and allies in the same way, so that it, the sense of solidarity and rules that everyone follows will be less pronounced. There will be much less of a sense that the Americans are the guarantors of a system for all. It will be a system of a bunch of different people talking with a bunch of different people. So there's a psychological and a practical element to the abrogation or the incompletion of the TPP.
That is former U.S. Ambassador Cameron Munter speaking with my colleague Lori London. Looking back at those 2 days spent in China, President Trump declared his government and China would be working together to liberate the region and the world from what he called the very serious threat posed by the murderous regime in North Korea. VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman, traveling with President in Beijing, reports the topic of North Korea, along with the huge U.S.-China trade gap, dominated the talks.
Alongside Chinese President Xi Jinping, Trump declared that Washington and Beijing agreed not to repeat the mistakes of the past in dealing with Pyongyang, which over the years has managed to rapidly advance its nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs.
The entire civilized world must unite to confront the North Korean menace, and the entire world is watching us right now.
In his scripted remarks, Xi was more muted.
On the Korean Peninsula nuclear issue, we reiterated the firm commitment to achieving denuclearization of the peninsula and upholding the international nonproliferation regime. The two sides will continue to fully and strictly implement UN Security Council resolutions. At the same time, the two sides commit to working towards a solution through dialogue and negotiation.
Trump earlier said excellent progress, including on North Korea, was made in his talks with the Chinese leader.
And I do believe there's a solution to that, as you do.
At a formal welcome outside the Great Hall of the People, the two leaders walked side by side on a red carpet. A military band played the national anthems of the two countries, and ceremonial cannon fire from Tiananmen Square saluted Trump. An exuberant crowd of schoolchildren waved American and Chinese flags. The talks between Trump and Xi also dealt with trade, a touchy subject since the U.S. president has long complained about the trade imbalance between China and the United States. Trump said the U.S. trade deficit with China is shockingly hundreds of billions of dollars annually, and that past administrations allowed it to get so far out of kilter.
But, I don't blame China. After all, who can blame a country for being able to take advantage of another country for the benefit of its citizens?
China and the United States are the two largest economies and important engines of global economic growth. We need to further expand trade and investment cooperation, strengthen macroeconomic policy investment cooperation, pursue healthy, stable, and dynamically balanced economic and trade relations.
Both leaders played up what they referred to as $250 billion worth of business deals signed during President Trump's visit here, but a sizable chunk are non-binding memorandums that may never materialize. Steve Herman, VOA News, Beijing.
You can stay on top of President Trump's Asia trip at our website. Find us at voanews.com. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. Women farmers in Tanzania are taking on their local governments in a big way. The smallholder farmers usually do not have a voice in decisions regarding their farming businesses. However, through their own initiative and with the help of a project developed by ActionAid USA, the women now hold their governments accountable by tracking how and where public money is spent. In addition, they are demanding that the government support any services that they need. Chris Cox is the Director of Communication at ActionAid. He spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about how the smallholder farmers are taking charge of their own livelihoods.
Up to 80% of Africa's food is produced by local farmers, and the majority of those farmers are women. But often what actually happens is in many African countries, women don't actually have control over the land that they're farming or access to a lot of the tools and the techniques that they need in order to make their farm successful. What we found in Tanzania was that there was a great project that the government was supporting outside of the capital, Dodoma, in an area called Chamwino. And essentially, as part of the project, the farmers had access to small pieces of land that they put into this bigger vineyard that was producing grapes. The problem was that all of the farmers were harvesting grapes at the same time, which meant that all of the grapes were being released onto the market and prices were really diving. And the income that the farmers were getting wasn't sufficient in order to be able to maintain their farms. So as part of the project, the government had committed to building a processing plant. And the processing plant was really important in that the farmers would be able to deliver their grapes, have them turned into grape juice, and they also had an agreement with a local wine producer who would use the grapes in order to produce wine. And the idea being there that they were able to maximize the income that they were making. But ultimately what happened is that the farmers started growing grapes themselves. They started using their own savings to invest in the land. But the processing plant was never built. So the problem there was obviously that the farmers were left with loads of grapes, but the markets that they had access to was very limited. The auditing that the women farmers themselves started doing is all designed really looking at the promises that the government had made and the money that was committed to support this project and where it's gone and looking at the reasons as to why this processing plant hadn't been delivered. In the course of doing the work, they've developed better connections with the local government ministries, which has obviously meant that they're better able to target the spending and deliver some of the services that farmers needed. And they've also got a commitment that the government will follow through with its promise and deliver this processing plant that they need to really maximize their income.
So going forward, are they going to go ahead and build this plant?
I was in Tanzania in July, and when I left, I had spoken to a local official who's responsible for agriculture policy, and he said that they were about to sign a contract with a company to build the processing plant. That has come as a direct result of the community members, these local women farmers, being much more involved in the direction of the project. And this is an approach that ActionAid takes across our work with local farmers. We work in more than 18 countries in sub-Saharan Africa. And we, you know, really working at the local level to get farmers more involved in agriculture policy, because often what we find is that farmers, they're doing a lot of the work and they're producing up to 80% of Africa's food. But when factors change, so issues like climate change happen, farmers are the first people that will go hungry. What's really important here is to have farmers much more connected with agriculture policy so that they can firstly really make sure that the services that they needed are provided for in public budgets, because the government is the biggest investor in agriculture in Africa, and that's vital for the success of agriculture going forward. But also to make sure that what the farmers really need in order to expand their farms and to make their farms a success, and that's really covered in terms of what's being delivered.
So I guess the women feel empowered to really do something, and it has worked.
The really important part of this work is that it is local farmers that are taking the initiative, and they're the ones that are driving forward this work. And this is really important, because in order to be sustainable and to have long-term impact, it needs to be local farmers that are taking the lead.
He is Chris Cox, in Director of Communications at ActionAid USA, speaking with Kim Lewis, who is host of the VOA program Africa News Tonight. Also in the news, we turn to American politics, where a candidate for the United States Senate, Roy Moore of Alabama, has been accused of engaging in inappropriate contact with a 14-year-old girl nearly four decades ago. The Washington Post newspaper published the story Thursday. Moore denied the allegations in a statement calling them completely false and a desperate political attack by the National Democratic Party and the Washington Post on his campaign. Catherine Gibson covers Congress for VOA.
Well, I mean, these allegations exploded across Capitol Hill on Thursday, and it was well Republicans were putting together a very high-profile tax bill. They passed it out of committee. This should be a very triumphant moment for Paul Ryan and House Republicans as the first step of something that they've really pushed legislatively for a very long time. And instead, they were being asked about these allegations against Roy Moore.
Three other women also accused Moore of pursuing them during the same period, although none of the women said Moore tried to initiate any sort of relationship or sexual contact with them. All of the women were between the ages of 16 and 18 at the time, in an era when he was in the early 30s. U.S. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell issued a statement on Thursday calling on Moore to drop out of the election if those allegations are true. Now we turn to look at what's happening in the world of social media. Here's VOA's Andrew Palchevsky.
Two big names in the digital world are speaking out about the hidden power of social media. The first is Brad Pascal. He ran the digital operation for Donald Trump's presidential campaign. At a web conference in Portugal this week, Pascal addressed Russian interference on social media, downplaying its impact. He said, quote, "I don't want Russia or any other entity to meddle in our election more than any other American. However, I think the scale and the scope of it was pretty tiny." He went on to say that Facebook and the platforms should probably regulate and make sure foreign entities don't come in. That's their responsibility, and the government and Facebook can figure that out. He also addressed claims that the campaign knowingly spread social media content published by Russian trolls, telling attendees that he had no idea that Russia was using Twitter, Facebook, and other social networks to influence U.S. opinion. He further explained that, like millions of people around the world, he often retweets content without giving any thought to who's behind it. Pascal also spoke about the Trump campaign's digital strategy, which used demographics and analytics to direct tens of thousands of pieces of digital content to different specific audiences. Now, all that targeting brought in more than $280 million in campaign contributions, of which the campaign reinvested more than $100 million into digital advertising. It was that degree of digital advertising and targeting, according to Pascal, that made their campaign so successful, and ultimately delivered the presidency to Donald Trump. And the second big name in the digital world who's speaking out is Sean Parker, one of the co-founders of Facebook. Speaking with the news organization Axios this week, Parker is giving an alarming glimpse into the strategy behind the social network. Parker says that Facebook's goal is to monopolize as much of its users' time as possible, calling the network a social validation feedback loop that exploits a vulnerability in human psychology. The idea, he says, is to make it rewarding to post and comment and share so that you do it more and more and more. And all of that posting and commenting and sharing, Parker says, is changing our relationships with society and each other, making people less productive, and, he suggests, even having an impact on children's mental development. Now, there's been no response from Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg or anyone else from the social network, but Parker did joke that after his comments, he wouldn't be surprised if he was blocked from Facebook.
That is VOA's Andrew Palchevsky. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
A cattle farm in Mareeba County in northern Queensland, Australia, fetches top dollar for the cattle they breed.
If people know that the prison cattle are coming in, we get phone calls and, weeks out.
Kate Knowles is a livestock agent, and you heard her right. These are so-called prison cattle because prisoners at the Lotus Glen Correctional Center help raise the cattle as part of a training program to give inmates job skills. Les Elliott is the farm's manager.
If you treat people with respect and they have acknowledgement for the work that they're doing, then their demeanor and their attitude changes.
The farm sells $100,000 of cattle each year. Properly raised, cattle at Lotus have a quiet, gentle temper, assets buyers demand. The successful program also graduates prisoners who go on working at cattle stations across the country. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. And now it's time for our music feature. Mel Carter is an American singer and actor, once described as being one of the best musical stylists of all times. Band of Gold was a super hit for Carter, who was born in the U.S. state of Ohio in 1939.
But till the end of time, there'll be a little band of gold to prove that you are mine. I've never wanted wealth untold, but till the end of time.
Mel Carter's first hit was in 1962, recording on Sam Cooke's label, SAR. And by the time he reached his commercial peak with Imperial Records in the middle of the decade, he was specializing in pop ballads like Love Is All We Need.
Love is all we need, so won't you take me in your arms?
Jones recognized Carter's talent and signed him to record his debut pop session on Mercury Records, which showcased his passionate vocals and immediately began turning heads throughout the recording industry. In his early days, Mel Carter sang with the all-male group, the Los Angeles Gospel All-Stars. Later, he acted on TV programs such as Sanford and Son, Marcus Welby, and Magnum P.I. However, Mel Carter's biggest success was the top 10 Billboard Hot 100 hit, Hold Me, Thrill Me, Kiss Me, which reached number 8 in 1965. It sold more than 1 million copies and was awarded a gold disc. Yep, Mel Carter, one of the true gentlemen of the world of music. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Thomas Blondet, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a super Friday. Now, a bit more from Mel Carter. When you take me in your arms and drive me slowly out of my mind, kiss me, and when you do, I know that you will miss me, if we ever say adieu, so kiss me, make me tell you I'm in love with you. Tell you I'm in love with you. Never, never, never let me go. Never, never, never let me go.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Ambassador to Ghana, Robert Jackson, recently honored 9 Ghanaian communities selected to receive grants to promote education, agriculture, and economic growth at the local level. The grants, totaling $75,000, are part of the ambassador's small grants program. Speaking at the signing ceremony, Ambassador Jackson praised the communities for developing sustainable, high-impact, community-supported projects. As grantees, you are joining a distinct group of communities and organizations throughout Ghana, he noted. You have demonstrated that you can unite your political, civil society, religious, and business leaders to provide for the needs of your community, with a little extra assistance from the U.S. government. But in reality, the real efforts are yours, and we are honored to be your partner. Projects selected for funding include construction of an electrical workshop in the Ashanti region, completion of a school dining hall in the Ashanti region, completion of a primary school and a junior high school in the same region, the purchase of new furniture and learning materials for the Castle Road Special School in Accra, completion of a classroom block in the Upper West region, and the reconstruction of a shea butter processing facility in the Upper West region. In addition, 3 organizations will receive grants to buy new Gary processing equipment and stoves. The Nyambe Kiyeri Women's Gary Processing Association in the Brong-Ahafo region, the Premier Agribusiness Association in the Eastern region, and the Miyingor Farmers Group in the Volta region. The Ambassador's Small Grants and Special Self-Help Program has provided support to grassroots development efforts since 1964. Over the last 3 decades, the U.S. Embassy in Accra has distributed more than $2.3 million in such grants to support community development projects. The U.S. is proud to work with its public and private sector partners in Ghana to promote education, agriculture, and economic development for the people of Ghana.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.